This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, we look at some of the events and issues we covered on the Environment Show in 1997. El Niño and the weather. We considered what Wall Street said it would do to the economy. Russian markets continue to expand. We covered what this means for the Siberian tiger. We remember environmentalist and singer John Denver, and we sailed down the Hudson River on the sloop named Clearwater. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to the Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. El Niño, the warming of the South Pacific that has worldwide effects on the climate. It started last summer. It may be the earliest and strongest El Niño yet recorded. We went to Wall Street to find out about its economic impact.
We have previously reported that an El Niño is now forming faster and earlier than perhaps any other El Niño event. An El Niño is a warming of the ocean in the southern Pacific, which then changes climate from Indonesia across the Pacific to the west coast of Latin America. It ultimately causes the southwest coast of the United States to be wetter and the winter in the northern portion of our country to be milder. In our continuing series on El Niño, we heard that sea lion and seal populations in California will probably drop significantly. Now, we consider the economic impact of the El Niño on the Andean countries in South America. Peter Greenbaum is vice president and Latin American economist for the New York investment banking and brokerage firm Smith Barney. He's telling investors that they need to be aware of the effects of the coming El Niño.
What we are telling our clients is to be aware of the implications of the weather anomaly upon the region, specifically the west coast of Latin America, as well as positive effects we can see in Argentina.
Greenbaum says it's possible that Western countries, Peru, Chile, and Ecuador, will see a lower rate of economic growth than normal. But the different countries may be affected in different ways.
While the fish crop off of Peru may fail to appear this year, that could be to the benefit of Chile. If we see migration of fish population from Peru to more temperate waters, Chile would benefit from that. But that's not always the case.
So, thinking specifically, if someone were to come to you and seek financing for a fish processing operation in Peru, would you advise that they move to Chile instead?
That's a good question. I might... for a period of time, the processing industry in Peru would not be a good investment.
While Greenbaum sees El Niño hurting the coastal Andean countries because wet places will be drier and dry places will be wetter, he says it will help the economy in Argentina. The Andean mountains protect Argentina from the direct impact of El Niño storms, flooding, and drought, while the price it gets for its agricultural exports will go up.
El Niño is not just a South America phenomenon. It's really a global phenomenon. Severe events can be associated with disruptions in supply of agricultural commodities, specifically wheat and other grains. So given a... really no change in demand, if you have a drop in major wheat-producing nations, a drop in output, rather, you should see a higher price as a result. And Argentina will certainly should benefit from that phenomena. On the other hand, the loss of the fish crop in Peru and fish meal then as a result, fish meal is a feedstock for the livestock industry. You could see the livestock industry move to other alternative forms of feed, such as soya. And Argentina is a large producer of soya as well.
Greenbaum also thinks that El Niño could have an impact on oil prices, which might help us, but would hurt Latin American countries like Mexico and Venezuela.
We believe that the El Nino this year will mean a warmer than usual winter in the U.S. and in Europe. And this should have an effect, a depressing effect, upon oil prices. Well, very good for the U.S. economy because we're importers. Major oil producing and exporting countries should be hurt by this. And to a certain extent, Mexico is one of those economies. But oil is not as important as it once was. Manufacturing sector exports are much more important than oil, but they will be hurt. They will be getting fewer dollars because of the lower oil price. Venezuela is another country which is almost totally dependent upon oil, and they certainly could be hurt if oil prices respond by falling sharply during this warm winter that we're anticipating.
He says the weather plays a role in the strategic investment decisions of a global financial firm like Smith Barney, so they have a full-time meteorologist on staff. If I'm a major client and I'm planning a fishing trip, will your meteorologist tell me whether to take rain gear?
It depends on how major a client are you.
In making his economic forecasts, Greenbaum has no doubt that El Nino will have an impact.
The only thing that might be able to stop it right now, or stop it from getting worse, is a volcanic eruption on the Pinatubo variety. I'm not in the business.
How about a 1,000-point drop in the Dow?
that won't do it.
Peter Greenbaum is Vice President and Latin American Economist for the Smith Barney Company. At the beginning of the century, 8 subspecies of tiger were found in the earth. Today, there are only 5, as 3 have become extinct. The most magnificent is the Panthera tigris altica, otherwise known as the Siberian tiger. The biggest of the world cats, the male Siberian tiger, grows to 800 pounds in weight and 10 feet in length. With the opening of Russia to world trade and increasing logging in the Russian Far East, the fate of the Siberian tiger hangs in the balance. It's estimated that approximately 200 to 400 of the black and orange striped beasts still survive. Howard Quigley is president of the Hornica Wildlife Institute and co-director of the Siberian Tiger Project. The project seeks to develop long-range plans to ensure the survival of the huge cats. Quigley says simply being on land inhabited by the tiger is an unforgettable experience.
I think one thing about working with such an exotic animal in its own homeland is simply being able to see its own marks on the land. One of the most impressive situations that I've been in, and I've had many experiences around the world with different wildlife species, one of the most impressive situations I've ever been in is to walk through the Russian forest, or the Russian taiga, as they call it, in the snow, in a fresh snow, and then to come upon the tracks of Siberian tiger there in the snow, there in front of you, because it really is almost a mystical experience. Here's this huge track carved out in the snow, the pads of this mighty beast in the snow, you might say, and it's it truly makes humans humble in that sort of situation. It's truly a very powerful animal, but also a very omnipotent presence in that forest. It represents the Russian taiga more than any other animal.
Tiger habitat is not unlike parts of the United States.
Really, the Russian Far East is a combination of boreal and temperate environments, and it's a lot like the New England of the United States, the New England area, and a lot of broadleaf trees and higher elevation spruce fir forest. But it's one of the educational, you might say, difficulties we've had in telling the world about this place is that many people don't know anything about it. And once they see the pictures of where tigers live, they are quite aghast or even amazed by just how similar it is to parts of the United States or even northern Europe.
To save the tiger, Quigley maintains poaching must be stopped and habitat protected. A long-term habitat protection plan includes preservation of blocks of forest and corridors so tigers and other wildlife can move between them.
What we've tried to put in place right now is a long-term habitat protection plan, and what it does is integrates the prospects for development, whether it's mineral development or road development or forest products development, with the biological needs of not only the tiger, but a lot of the other species that live there. And what we've taken now to almost the highest levels of government in Russia is a plan that we think puts in place a template on the land that will allow for the long-term development, economic development, and the integration. For instance, this plan would allow for a corridor north to south in Tiger Range that would allow for the movement of animals, not only tigers but other animals, between protected areas and through those areas that would be more intensively logged or mined. And thus it allows for conservation in the long run, and also not just conservation but economic development of those resources.
Howard Quigley is the president of the Hornecker Wildlife Institute. The Russian Far East is vast, and the rush to extract its natural resources is intensifying. The Siberian Tiger Project is producing a plan to save the tiger. But the real problem now is to mobilize the political will to implement it in a Russian economic climate where environmental considerations have had little influence on no-holds-barred wheeling and dealing between Russians and foreign traders. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Have you wrestled a Siberian tiger recently? Give us a call and tell us about it. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. For many of us, John Denver is the environmental musician. His lyrics capture his love for Colorado and the natural world as a whole. Denver was active in various environmental causes and organizations, but it was the Windstar Foundation that he was closest to. Since his untimely death, the organization is entering a new phase and reflects the contributions of one of its co-founders. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott prepared this report.
When most people think of John Denver, they hear his music and picture a pristine landscape, probably of a mountain or a forest. Works like Country Roads, The Eagle and the Hawk, and Rocky Mountain High portray Denver's love of nature. It was an innate sense, present long before he became a famous singer. But soon after becoming a well-known musical artist, Denver turned his sights to environmental causes, focusing his attention on nature preservation. He co-founded the Windstar Foundation with friend Tom Crum. Jeannie Tomlinson is the foundation's managing director.
In 1976, John bought about 1,000 acres of land out here in Old Snowmass. It was a place he had dreamed about. And he and his manager, Hal Faw at the time, and Tom made up the first board of directors, and they were the staff in the very beginning. And then they expanded it and worked out an organization, designed programs, and in effect, in the early years, it was a school. And John described in his book that it was heady stuff to participate in. workshops and conferences focused on the environment and would be built around the connections between mind, body, and spirit.
Tomlinson says John's focus was on renewable forms of energy in the early years, but as times changed, so did his concerns.
So we did have wind machines and solar energy, and when Bucky Fuller was part of Windstar, we built the big biodome that was out here where we could grow fruits and vegetables just about year-round in a very harsh climate. That was important. And around that time is when John got real concerned about hunger in the world. And the Biodome Project was a way of teaching people to raise food in harsh environments in a controlled environment.
Tomlinson says Denver became involved with a number of groups, including National Audubon Society, the Cousteau Society, Planet 2000, Friends of the Earth, and the National Space Institute. Tomlinson says Denver's relationship to the natural world really began during childhood.
John grew up on a family farm in his early years, and he really connected with the earth, and he was more comfortable up in a tree or connecting with nature than in any other place. I really, truly believe it was an innate thing with him, that he had a passion for the environment as a child, and it was just something that was part of who he was always. He just felt strongly that if we don't care for the wild living places on Earth, that we would destroy the very thing that sustains us.
Tomlinson says John Denver was a professor, each song a form of lecture.
I really think that John left us a legacy of teachings through his music, which move us, not just inspire us, but move us to action to create a better world, to treat each other more kindly, so that we can add value to our relationships, to our community, to the planet. He had a passion for children, the environment, and a peaceful world. And to follow those attributes in our own lives is would be a wonderful tribute to John.
Tomlinson says she is certain the Windstar Foundation will change with Denver's passing. She believes, like the natural world, the organization John Denver co-founded will change and evolve with time. Tomlinson says not to continue the group would be a disservice to the man who tried so hard to increase awareness and promote appreciation of the natural world. I'm Stephen Westcott for The Environment Show. Rocky Mountain.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, setting sail on the Clearwater.
Take another step forward and bring the line with you. Okay, bring one more, take one more step, bring in the line with you. Okay, drop the line!
Sails up, and the Clearwater heads south out of Albany, New York, for a three-hour tour on the Hudson River. There's not much of a wind, and the boat, a 106-foot wooden sailing sloop, gently rocks on the calm waters. Designed after Dutch sloops of the 18th and 19th centuries, the Clearwater is the brainchild of folk singer Pete Seeger and friends. Believing that individuals can make a difference, the Clearwater was created to focus people's attention on the Hudson River. Since 1969, the sloop has served as a movable classroom, laboratory, and stage, bringing nearly 20,000 children and adults on board each year. Christopher Bowser is the boat's environmental educator.
We have different kinds of programs for different kinds of groups. Whatever people request, we like to talk to the teachers and see what they want to teach. We have a great program that we run called the Classroom of the Waves, which is centered on leave the dock, do a little fishing, some sampling to see what's in the water as far as the aquatic life there, raise the sails, get the whole group, whomever has on, to help raise those sails up, and then split up into five stations. You know, they might be plankton, or water chemistry, or mechanical advantage, the physics of sailing, navigation, fish. It can be a variety of different things.
The instruction happens all along the Hudson, from as far north as Albany to New York Harbor and Long Island Sound. With help from volunteers and staff members, the Clearwater, which is more than just the boat, is an organization which pursues strategies to improve water quality, protect critical habitat, promote water conservation, and clean up toxic waste so the Hudson River can be safe for the millions who live along its shore. Chris Bowser.
I think on the Hudson River, what it really boils down to is that what's good for the Hudson River is good for the people who live along the river, because they depend on the river for a lot of things. A lot of people get their drinking water from the river still. Still an extremely important avenue of transportation. Unfortunately, the once prevalent fishing industry is now just a fraction of what it was due to the level of PCBs in the water, which is too bad, because in the 1970s this is a $40 million industry, and now in the 1990s, as we approach the 21st century, fishing is all but unallowable.
PCBs remain the river's biggest source of contamination, and the group supports the idea of dredging. In addition to its education and advocacy roles, the Clearwater is about celebration. From its Great Hudson River Revival in June, a big waterfront festival that includes music, dance, folk arts, and crafts, to other events like a Shad and Pumpkin Festival, the Clearwater brings many the message that the river is a place to enjoy, which is certainly a sentiment shared by the crew of the ship. As one member said, "We do a lot of neat stuff." Keeping with the tradition of women captains serving on the Clearwater is Joy Oblix. She's been captain for around 20 months and describes the crew.
We have a great program with apprenticeship program, volunteers, interns, and then some paid crew. We have about three paid crew on board at any time, plus a captain and a cook and an educator. But as far as total, we can sleep about 18 people semi-comfortably. So with the volunteers and everyone else, we might have as many as 15 on board.
A gentle breeze picks up as the sun sets. Light from the galley below glows through the boat's skylight, and long lines of light reflect on the water that is now turning ink black with the night. Along the shore, commuters rush on the highway, unsuspecting of another world that lies within reach. Come to the river, Chris Bowser says, and check it out. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
Dropped by some hikers, one of things to tell. Ashland's Falls, 5,000 honest hands, work at the Consolidated.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a continued look at important stories of 1997. The environment is cities and neighborhoods as much as it is mountains and forests. Community land trusts and loan funds make urban revitalization possible. We talk green about auto emissions. Can and should car companies do more to build cleaner cars? And author Kent Nerbrunn presents a blue portrait of winter in Minnesota. Stay with us. Blighted and abandoned neighborhoods are all too common in American cities. Each area's downfall surely has a lengthy list of causes, but most share common problems with attracting investment and absentee landlords. In response, community loan funds and community land trusts have emerged as a major force in some cities. They provide loans and maintain properties which otherwise might fall into disrepair. Their success keeps the environment of cities alive and reduces pressure for development at the urban fringe. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally visited a land trust and loan fund in upstate New York and has this report.
The Hamilton Hill section of Schenectady, New York has seen better days. This part of the neighborhood was built when the General Electric Corporation was adding jobs in the 1930s. But since then, GE's cut back its workforce and the neighborhood's deteriorated. And as the area got worse, few banks were willing to risk lending their money. Meanwhile, many homeowners moved to other neighborhoods with more stable property values. Then a few years ago, a community land trust was formed, and financing became available through a community loan fund, bringing capital and energy into the neighborhood.
The key to the community land trust is that it retains the land and keeps it in trust for the community, and only sells the house. But what it does is create a partnership between the homeowner, the organization, which is made up of residents from the neighborhood as well as outside people. But the neighborhood residents are the ones who have the most control of the organization and determine what happens in situations. And the partnership that's then created between the homeowner, the organization, and the community helps to not just stabilize, a particular house, a particular piece of property, but the neighborhood in general.
Beverly Burnett is the executive director of Hill and Vale Affordable Housing. We stand in front of a property owned by Hill and Vale on a block that's long been in decline. Burnett says, think of your own neighborhood and how important local ownership is in keeping the community going. Burnett says when absentee landlords own properties, residents don't often have a sense of stewardship.
You look around and you can see the results of that in, you know, boarded up vacant houses with broken windows. And this neighborhood has, because of the absentee landlords, this neighborhood has become a place where people on social services tend to live because of the rents, and the absentee landlords will take Section 8, and you know there's certain codes that they have to meet, but they if they can get away with not putting any money into the house, they will. And I also believe that property values have dropped so much, it ends up being more beneficial for them to collect rent until the city comes and condemns the house and boards it up, and then the city takes it back in taxes and the person walks away, you know, from the house.
Similar situations exist all across the country. In many cases, the only time public and private money arrives is when the neighborhood is gentrified, and by then the low-income residents can no longer afford to remain. In Schenectady, gentrification is not a problem today. In fact, a little gentrification might be greatly appreciated. But Burnett says land trusts can work in gentrifying neighborhoods as well as those in decline.
A problem we face in redoing houses is they cost more to redo than what you can sell them for, what they can appraise for. But we've seen on a particular street that we've targeted, now we own five houses on, you can see that the street from 2 years ago has actually begun to stable out, and it's more homeowner occupied on that street. And as the community land trust grows in the neighborhood, it will again, help stabilize the community in terms of getting people who are homeowners into the house. It's not 100% true, but people tend to take better care of their house if they own it than if they're renting it.
The spiral of decline for a neighborhood often includes the loss of interest from mainstream corporations. Banks and insurance companies pull out, and businesses lose a base of customers. The practice of intentionally avoiding a neighborhood by banks and insurance companies is called redlining, and it's illegal. But community land trusts and loan funds work on the front lines and can act as magnets to bring diversified investment back into neighborhoods. Bob Radliff manages the Capital District Community Loan Fund in Albany, New York.
The red line that used to prohibit or prevent institutions such as banks from making investments in communities like this indeed helped establish and facilitate and force groups like community loan funds to evolve and be created. We kind of draw a red line around a community like this and say that's where we want to invest our money. More traditional lenders are kind of following groups like this lead, and they're kind of coming further and further towards what needs to be done to make loans to lower income people so that groups like Hill and Vale can then start working with even lower income people. So they're kind of pulling the free market system along with them to show that it can work and that they shouldn't be so afraid of making these kind of loans.
Radliff's organization has lent $3 million to about 90 groups and businesses. They've also leveraged about $20 million worth of loans. Compared to banks, that's not a lot of money, but most of their loans are meant to be small and are responsible for getting places like a car repair shop, a print shop, and many nonprofit organizations off the ground. And once they're up and running, it's easier to attract loans, insurance policies, and business. Each success for the Community Loan Fund means new life for troubled neighborhoods, and that keeps businesses and families in the city, increasing the quality of life, and reducing the need for more development in the suburbs.
But I think a goal of Hill and Vale Affordable Housing is to make the urban core more attractive so that more people will want to come and live here and use the existing infrastructure and therefore have less impact on the surrounding area. So I certainly think that's a primary goal of many inner city community development organizations.
Community loan funds and land trusts have increased dramatically in recent years. They and other organizations with different objectives but similar philosophies are now present in nearly every city in the U.S. You can get involved by either investing in them or donating your time. For The Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about what comes out of the tailpipe of your automobile. Recently, the chiefs of the big three U.S. automakers told President Clinton that mandatory emissions reductions would spell disaster for their industry. My guests today are Dan Becker. He's the director of the Global Warming and Energy Program with the Sierra Club, and he was appointed by President Clinton to a commission on auto exhaust emissions. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Also with us is Dr. Richard Klimisch. He's Vice President of Engineering Affairs with the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, and he's an expert on alternative fuels and was one of the pioneers of the catalytic converter. He joins us from Detroit, Michigan. And so, Dick Klimisch, let's start with you. A lot of people say the American auto industry lives with its head in the sand. They say that technological improvement is not possible, and yet the next thing you know, the Japanese are selling cars in the United States, which seem to do what the manufacturers have been resisting. And just this week, I note that Toyota has announced that it will be selling a hybrid car in Japan for about $17,000, that will get 56 miles per gallon. Why doesn't Detroit get behind efforts to dramatically reduce auto exhaust?
Well, we are. In fact, we have a program that's part of the Clean Air Act that's technology forcing that runs clear out past 2004, And in fact, we have the big three have introduced a whole series of cars. Now, the electric vehicle activities of General Motors are second to none. The Toyota announcement on hybrids is very impressive. We all have hybrid vehicles. The question is, a couple questions, the cost issue, whether the consumers will buy the vehicles, but we believe we're behind this. I think that the U.S. auto industry dominates industrial research and development. We have very large programs, in fact.
Okay. Well, Dan Becker from Sierra, do you agree that the U.S. auto industry dominates these programs and is on top of the power curve?
I think it would be shocking to people in other countries if they looked at the big three U.S. auto producers and saw how they run from technology. On the shelves in Detroit are scads of different technologies that would make our cars cleaner and more efficient. And if we don't produce those vehicles and create jobs in this country making vehicles that go further on a gallon of gas, surely we will end up importing them from Japan and Europe. And it really is our responsibility. More carbon dioxide pollution, the major pollutant that causes global warming, comes spewing out of the tailpipes of America's cars and light trucks than out of all sources of global warming pollution in the entire country of India. So we have a responsibility to make reductions, and we have the technology that the industry refuses to put on its vehicles. In 1975, Congress passed a law called the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Law, the mile per gallon law. And at that time, Ford Motor Company testified that the law would never work, that, quote, it would require a Ford product line consisting of all sub-Pinto-sized vehicles or some mix of vehicles ranging from a sub-subcompact to perhaps a Maverick, close quote. They've always said it can't be done, and we need to require that they do it for our children's future.
Okay, well, let's look at that issue, because I think the magic word there was require. And Dick, that I assume is a word which puts the manufacturers in orbit. They don't want to be required to do this. Why not?
Well, the fundamental problem is that we have a free market, and we can make cars that better fuel economy, but the question is, will the customers buy it? And that gets down to the price of gasoline. You know, the price of gasoline is $5 a gallon. I think it's like $6 in Italy, and you can put, for example, technology like very lightweight materials that are very expensive, but at a buck a gallon, it doesn't pay for the customers. And if you'll notice, the importers in the U.S. are producing the similar kind of cars. The Japanese small cars, like the Accord, started as a small car, and now they're mid-size.
Well, let's just look at that issue for a minute. If, and people may not agree with this, but if one of the national objectives should be to reduce air pollution, what is the best way to get there, at least from the perspective of the auto manufacturers, in the most rapid and cost-effective way?
Well, the program we've got is working very well. As I said, the 90 amendments to the Clean Air Act haven't really run their course. We're making incredible progress.
But when those amendments were passed, isn't Dan Becker right that the auto industry just resisted those from beginning to end?
Following
Becker's argument, maybe it ought to be done again.
We've tried to change that. The question, as you mentioned, is cost effectiveness, how fast you can do it, and whether you can make a vehicle that anyone will buy. The electric vehicle mandate in California is an example. They had to give up on that because, you know, the vehicles aren't selling. We're selling.
Well, wait a minute, Dick. They gave up on that because of pressure from the auto and oil industry on the governor, and he caved.
No, it was technology.
You hadn't introduced the cars yet. Look, right now we have the technology to make cars go further on a gallon of gas and meet the other requirements that people want for a car. It doesn't have to change the size or the performance of the car in order to make it go further on a gallon of gas. People will save money at the gas pump. We can thumb our nose at Saddam Hussein and his oil, but the auto industry won't get off its tailpipe and begin to make these changes.
Dan, we got 50-mile-per-gallon cars out there. They're not selling. They're in the marketplace already.
Well, Dick, let me ask you something. You say you've got 50-mile cars, and they're not selling because they don't have the performance, perhaps, than others. What about producing a vehicle that does have the performance? Is that technologically impossible?
Sure it is. No, it's possible, but then you get into the trade-off is cost, because, and so you have to balance these things. It's a competitive market. If we abandon the market, somebody else is going to take it over. I mean, as I say, it's a free market. So,
well, Dick, that's the first thing you said I agree with you on. Honda has introduced a vehicle that is a Honda Civic that for $700 more than another Honda Civic, you get a 55% improvement in fuel economy. And what we need to do is we need to educate the American people that those choices may exist, but the big three should be producing those vehicles. We shouldn't have to import them all from Japan.
We are producing those vehicles. There's a number of big three vehicles that are over 50 miles per gallon, but the sales of that segment of the market is pretty small, and I believe it's primarily because of the price of fuel in this country.
Well, you talked about the EV1 and how people aren't buying it. You didn't mention that General Motors is rejecting 3/4 of the people who apply to buy that vehicle. So General Motors isn't doing what it should be doing if it really wanted to make that vehicle a success. And what the American people need to do is we need to have rules that require the auto industry to move forward. It's since 1989 when the CAFE standards stopped.
Why don't we have rules on what kind of cars people can buy? I mean, it is free. It's still a free country, Dan. Let me ask you both something.
Hold on just a second. If one were to put in generic kind of rules that were specific about emissions and perhaps miles per gallon, is it your position, Dick, that the industry simply could not produce a marketable product in accordance with those rules?
No, we already have the system. We've got both the fuel economy and emission laws by EPA and by NHTSA are based on technological feasibility. And that's, you know, we have lots of argument about what's technological feasible, but ultimately when that's decided, we deliver, and we're meeting the laws, and where technological feasibility is today.
You guys have lobbied Congress to freeze the mile per gallon standard so that you don't have to put the technology that exists on those vehicles to let them go further on a gallon of gas. Since 1989, when the CAFE standards ran their course, you guys have been going backward on fuel economy, not forward. And this year, the average fuel economy, the average miles per gallon of the fleet of domestic vehicles is at the 1980 level. Inefficient as we were back in 1980.
That's
nuts.
Well, what's happened, the cars, in fact, the CAFE law primarily was for cars, and those went up to 27.5 miles per gallon. The customer said, I need bigger, I need to tow, once a year I want to tow my boat up north, so I'm going to buy a truck, and people are buying trucks. What Dan's referring to is combining the cars.
Sure.
So people are buying more and more trucks.
But
station wagon is gone.
Isn't the next question whether if there were rules that applied to the trucks and the Suburbans and the utility vehicles, whether those wouldn't improve performance because the law would apply to them too?
Well, sure, you could make laws that improve the fuel economy. One of the reasons people buy trucks is perceptions about safety, and utility and towing capacity, all those things. As I say, it's still a free market, and I really think Congress wouldn't pass a law because these kinds of vehicles are important to people. We talk often about the problems of vehicles, pollution and accidents, but there are a lot of benefits people get out of vehicles, and I think you keep forgetting about those: the privacy, the independence, the freedom of mobility. I mean, it's the envy of the world.
But the problem is that these emissions that spew out of these vehicles are jeopardizing the future for our children. They're making the climate warm, they're polluting and filling our cities with smog, and in order for our kids to live in a safer and healthier environment, we need to begin to clamp down on these emissions. And if Detroit won't do it by itself, then obviously the government needs to have a role here. Otherwise, our kids are going to grow up in a greenhouse, and I don't think you want that either, Dick.
Let me ask the technical question here. I think a lot of us have such faith in American technology, or technology in general, that we assume we can do anything. Are you saying, Dick, that if one had strict requirements with respect to fuel economy and so on, one could not produce with today's technology the sport utility vehicles and the pickups that would meet the consumer demand because
from an engineering point of view, it just can't be done?
Well, if you put in cost and performance, any individual company that tried that, let's say, to reduce performance or increase cost, is going to lose in the marketplace.
And I gather that's a position, Dan, that you don't necessarily agree with.
No, this is the industry that said we can't make cars with seat belts, we can't make cars with airbags, we can't make cars with catalytic converters for smog, and now they say we can't make cars or light trucks that get over 27.5 miles per gallon. We're America. We've got technology. The auto industry won't use it, but we can solve these problems if the auto industry will help and stop looking at their short-term, short-sighted bottom line for this year and think about the future. At some point, it is likely that oil prices are going to rise, Dick, and at that point, you guys are going to get caught behind the eight ball when the Japanese come in and say, we're ready, we'll sell you efficient cars and trucks, and the American big three say, gee, give us 5 years.
Well, you know, Dan, I got to say something about the air pollution. We think we've made incredible progress on air pollution, and that will continue. In terms of global warming, that's a big threat to this country, and your story about greenhouse, I don't believe, is shared by science. That's a very controversial issue in spite of some claims to the controversy.
Well, and the tobacco industry still says that smoking doesn't cause cancer.
Well, that's fine, but this is bigger. I mean, the Senate passed a resolution 95-0. I mean, that's a pretty big statement in terms of their view of the approach we're taking to global warming.
Let me ask both of you in our short time remaining, what needs to be done to improve technology the most rapidly? Dick, just 20 seconds.
Well, the answer to these problems is clearly technology, but part of it may be public policy as well. But we need some technological breakthroughs. What I'm really worried about is the global warming problem. And that gets to countries like China and India. If they're not going to use fossil fuels, we've got to find some way to help them. And it's an incredible technological challenge. But what we can't do is impoverish America in the bargain, as an example.
Okay. Dan Becker, your view on that?
Dick is right that technology is the answer. Technology already exists to make cars go further on a gallon of gas, and we have both the moral obligation to our kids and the responsibility and opportunity to sell these technologies to China.
Okay, I'm afraid our time is up, and I want to thank you all for joining us. My guests have been Dan Becker from the Sierra Club and Dick Klimisch from the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. We've been talking green about auto emissions, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. We're going to be discussing wolves and their reintroduction. If you'd like to join us on air, let us know. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can reach us over the net where you can hear the Environment Show anytime. It's www.enn.com/envshow. It's the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're on city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Kent Nerburn takes us for a walk in the snow in northern Minnesota. He reads from his book, A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land. It's published by New World Library.
Blue. I walked today, knee-deep in snow that had a sparkle on its surface. Each footstep lifted clouds of winter diamonds, azure blue and crystalline, like fire sparks of ice. It is a day of blue this winter morning. The blue-hued snow betrays its water source within. Tree trunks echo blue in sympathetic harmony. Even the wind blows blue, cool, edgy, soothing, and serene. And above it all, a cobalt sky vaults insurmountable in cloudless brilliance, casting shadows long and lavender across the land. It is the palette of a genius painter this winter day, a Chinese watercolor, but with edges sharp and cutting as a knife. If you would live in winter, you must give yourself to blue, not as a color or as a winsome sadness, but as a distance receding from the surface that turns at every point to meditation. It is like the echo in a vast architecture, a footfall in a great cathedral. I step. The snow crusts beneath me. Its surface breaks like the shattering of glass. Above me, a jay perches, then swoops, his actions leaving no track or trace, his flight a fugue against the sky. Not so with me. The tracks I leave do not return to stillness, but shape a landscape of intent. Into the blue soliloquy I send a march, a cadence with a purpose. On days like this, I do not love our mortal grounding. I am revealed too much for who I am. I can push forward into endless purity, but if I turn, as honesty demands, I see my history revealed, and my single path betrays the gentle vesper of the land. We may, as Wordsworth says, come trailing clouds of glory, but once that glory touches down, we leave our mark. I would rather seek the margins of the woods than cut a razor path across the land. If I must live in counterpoint, let it be a gentle sound.
Kent Nerburn, from his book A Haunting Reverence, Meditations on a Northern Land, published by New World Library. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you're getting too much smoke out of the exhaust pipe of your automobile, you need a copy of this program. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 418. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.